Hi. Today on the Loopcast, we're going to be talking about Tunisia, particularly Ansar al-Sharia in Tunisia. The reason we wanted to do this, the Loopcast, is because, in the sort of the larger media, and not the our organization, there's been a very much a focus on Egypt, on Syria. Even parts of Lebanon, but never really Tunisia, sort of this birthplace of the Arab Spring. And we wanted to sort of bring it to focus and sort of discuss it. Because it is, arguably the birthplace place of the Arab Spring, and it's arguably sort of, one of the first places where you did see a sort of transition, a political transition to, democracy, or sort of, away from a traditional authoritarian system, so to speak. So today, we're talking to David. He's published two papers. One last year, Ansar al-Sharia in Tunisia, The Long Game, Dawa Hizb Jihad. I think I messed that up, but we'll post it when we publish the episode. And the newest paper, Raising the Stakes, Ansar al-Sharia in Tunisia and Its Shift to Jihad. So we're going to be talking about the two papers today. So I want to start off with David, sort of reviewing your paper that you published before this newest one, and sort of, give us an outline of Ansar al-Sharia in Tunisia's sort of core tenets. It's, the Dawah, the Hizbah, and its sort of jihad.
Absolutely. As you said, this is a paper that I published in May of last year. Subsequently, a lot has changed, which is the reason why I published a follow-up paper so soon after the first one. But as of May, Ansar al-Sharia is a jihadist group. I'll get to its strategy as of May in a second. But it's a jihadist group, and it adheres to al-Qaeda's ideology, which I use not just as a general descriptor, but actually a very specific one. The group has, in explaining its ideology in public releases, has talked about its loyalty specifically to al-Qaeda's ideology, which is a very interesting phraseology. Not just one that talks about principles that are like al-Qaeda's, but it does talk about al-Qaeda's ideology specifically. Now, as of May, they had a strategy that fit fairly well in terms of taking advantage of some of the new freedoms that came after the Ben Ali regime in Tunisia collapsed. They, as you said, had a strategy that was based on three prongs: Dawah, Hizbah, and Jihad. And Dawah, the first of these, is an Arabic term which is best translated as evangelism. The group would evangelize fairly aggressively. When I did field research there in April of 2013, I was able to watch some of their Dawah tables in the city of Sousse, for example, where they'd pass out literature, talk to passersby, and they were also very well known for going throughout the country providing social services, which would generally be accompanied again by literature supporting their cause. The second prong, Hizbah, is a reference to cleansing of the Muslim community. Hizbah refers specifically to a concept derived from the Quran, which is enjoining the good and forbidding the bad. It's a somewhat difficult term to translate, but the way it operates for Ansar al-Sharia specifically is it manifested often in vigilante violence, which there was really a wave of as of last year. That actually has very much changed. Between my last two times doing field research there, I did field research in April 2013 and just about a week ago in February 2014. And between the two visits, the amount of vigilante violence that was designed to support Salafist norms has significantly declined. Now, I should say that not all of that vigilante violence could be attributed to Ansar al-Sharia. You had actually multiple actors there, but this was something which was by design. Ansar al-Sharia had a very opaque organizational structure, which meant that the group could engage in violence, and it certainly was engaged in several kinds of violence, while simultaneously disclaiming any sort of responsibility. The third prong was jihad, which, in contrast to Hizbah violence, jihad violence is designed to not cleanse the faith internally, but to attack external enemies, whether they're the state government of Tunisia or Western powers. Jihad is aimed outward. And as of May, jihad was very much in the background. There were some kinds of violence that it was engaged in that I would describe as jihad. For example, they were engaged in fighting. They had a link to this group called Katibat Uqba ibn Nafi that operated between Algeria and Tunisia and was engaged in fighting at Tunisia's largest mountain range, the Jebel Shambi Mountains. And you know, the Tunisian state said that AST was a part of this Katibat Uqba ibn Nafi. But overall, jihad was not at the forefront of what they did. The foremost strategy was to take advantage of these new freedoms, to engage in dawah, to engage in Hizbah violence, while at the same time disclaiming responsibility. And they hadn't made a shift into a stage of jihad against the state. Although I argued, based upon looking at public interviews that leaders had given, they did embrace the notion that eventually there'd be an all-out war with the state, and that they were preparing for it, and eventually a shift to jihad was likely to come.
Interesting. So now we sort of flash forward to 2014. You know, what has sort of caused this shift to jihad, to away from sort of, you know, vigilante violence and proselytization to outright warfare? I mean, what has shifted, and what circumstances have changed to sort of push the group, you know, away from, you know, spreading the word, so to speak, to, you know, engaging in outright warfare, so to, you know.
Well, the main thing that shifted is that the state cracked down on them. I'll get to the crackdown in a second, but let me preface it by saying that I talked recently to a researcher who, though not a specialist on Tunisia, is working on a book on al-Qaeda's global strategy. And this researcher actually challenged my assertion that that AST has moved into the jihad phase at this point. And the argument is that these stages, you know, that number one, these stages, like with an event stage of jihad, is something that can be seen in al-Qaeda documents as being a very firm progression, and each stage has very definitive meanings. The researcher's counter was that it's not clear that they've actually entered that last stage of jihad. And I actually am prefacing with that because I think that while their use of jihad violence has increased, it's possible that they haven't, in their own mind, entered that stage. It has become more prominent. In that case, in that way, saying that there's a shift to jihad is accurate, but it's possible that they don't actually consider themselves to be in a stage of outright warfare yet. And the reason why is because, you know, according to research that others have done, and I haven't yet gone over the primary source documents, so I'm just putting forward what other researchers have asserted, that you know, it's possible that all of the prerequisites have not been met. So with that caveat aside, turning to the question of what has changed, what changes at the state crackdown? That's the primary change. During the course of and that was prompted by events. During the course of 2013, there were two assassinations in Tunisia. The first one in February was of a politician named Shokri Belaid. He was gunned down outside his house. And after that, you got massive demonstrations, in particular focusing on the ruling Islamist party, Ennahda. And then there was another assassination that occurred in July of Mohamed Brahmi. Now, that assassination was coupled with another event which really pushed the conflict to the point of no return. That other event is, you know, I mentioned before the Jebel Shambi Mountains and how there was this constant fighting between Katibat Uqba ibn Nafi, which was linked to Ansar al-Sharia, and the state. And within 5 days of Mohamed Brahmi's assassination, another incident occurred. That other incident was that 8 members of the Tunisian security forces were killed, which, you know, might not sound like a lot to us, but that was the deadliest day for Tunisian security forces in the history of the country. The second thing that happened on top of that was that five of these security forces' throats were slit. So just as both a grisly murder and also something which in the region is very much seen as a sure sign of jihadist activity. The slitting of throats was something that was commonly employed, for example, during the Algerian Civil War. And so with the combination of those two events, and both of those assassinations were blamed by the government on AST, with a combination of those two events, what the government decided to do was to crack down on Ansar al-Sharia. They designated a terrorist organization, they made it illegal, and they have been conducting raids against weapons caches and the like since then.
Interesting. So what has been sort of Ansar al-Sharia's targets? I mean, if it's a government crackdown that has sort of, you know, pushed them to employing a lot more violence, I mean, are they targeting military intelligence buildings and personnel? I mean, who is the sort of the main target of Ansar al-Sharia?
Well, one thing that we should clarify, this is very important, is when people talk, there really has been a significant uptick in violence in Tunisia. But you're starting from a baseline of a very orderly country. So when we talk about how a lot more security forces have been killed in Tunisia last year, I'll actually kick this to you. Why don't you take a guess as to how many were killed in 2013?
100.
The answer is 24.
Wow. Okay.
So, and the reason I asked that question, and because talking to almost everybody who's not a Tunisia specialist, there, and even people who spend a lot of time reading about it, there's a perception as though the violence is much more than it is. You know, it's real and it's a problem. But you had a total of you know, 24 members of the security forces killed. Also, you know, a few civilians have been killed, but it's not, you know, the massive wave that some people expect when they hear about this. And this is all very good news that it's not something that we'd consider epidemic proportions. So you have a few different areas in which violence has been used. One is at Jebel Shambi in the Algerian border. You have two different kinds of violence occurring, one of which is landmines that are set for security forces. And the second is occasional ambushes where members of the security forces will be killed. That's been going on since December of 2012. I mean, you had a few skirmishes before that. But in December 2012, you had actually an adjutant in the Tunisian National Guard, Anas Jalassi, get gunned down, which was a very big piece of news in Tunisia, something which caused the government to start devoting more resources to this particular problem. Then thereafter, you've had a few other targets of violence. There were a couple of incidents, one on October 30th and then the other in December, where AST members were allegedly trying to attack both tourist targets and also symbolic targets. On October the 30th, you had two attempted bombings that occurred near simultaneously. One of them was in Sousse, which is a beachside city. One individual attempted to walk inside a four-star hotel, the Riyadh Palms Resort. He was turned away by guards. They've actually, since May of last year, have massively increased security precautions at hotels, cafes, restaurants, something that was very clear to see during my last field research in Tunisia. But he was turned away. He ran out on the beach. He was being followed by security, and then the briefcase that he was holding blew up. At the time, the assumption that many had, including myself, was that he was a suicide bomber. In fact, he was reported as a suicide bomber, one reason that I thought that he was one. It seems like, as more evidence has come in, that he may not actually have been a suicide bomber, that the bomb in his briefcase may have been detonated remotely, which means he didn't necessarily intend to kill himself, but the fact that he intended to bomb a hotel was clear. Then, near simultaneously, you had another individual in the mausoleum of Habib Bourguiba, who's the founder of the modern Tunisian state, someone who is an ardent secularist and for that reason is very much a bête noire of the Islamists within the country. He was stopped by security forces before anything could happen, but his backpack was filled with explosives, which made his intentions very clear. Then in December, there was an arrest that occurred in which Tunisian security forces say that they recovered a number of a large amount of explosives, claiming that this cell, there are about six or seven people arrested, were planning attacks on tourists during the New Year's Eve celebrations. So that's been a primary target. Now, let me emphasize something in here, because I use the word allegedly a lot. There still is a question with respect to Ansar al-Sharia's organizational structure. As I mentioned before, it's an opaque organizational structure. So for a lot of these acts of violence and attempted acts of violence, there are questions of, number one, are these actually AST members? Number two, if so, are they acting pursuant to commands or are they acting on their own? Those are questions that prevail through all of this. Now, the Tunisian state's decision was to just go ahead and clamp down under the assumption that, number one, the organization's intentions are clear. It's a problem that's not going to go away. It's a problem that's likely to grow as they engage in dawah efforts. And it's designed specifically to allow them to engage in violence while also denying that they're doing so. So I understand the government's thinking, but one problem that researchers have is that it's not always clear who's ordering what.
Wait, what would be sort of the rationale for targeting tourist spots? I mean, is it really sort of this, trying to, ramp up as much attention to the action as possible? Because it seems like the state has clamped down, and it's the state that is sort of antagonizing the group. But yet, they've chosen to sort of target, or, in these acts that you've listed, they've sort of targeted tourist areas, not necessarily symbols of the state. So, I mean, what would be sort of the rationale, or sort of, why tourist? I mean, is it because the tourist sites are just soft and with a lower amount of security, or is there something deeper going on here?
Well, number one, given kind of the course of events, I wouldn't say it's clear. I wouldn't necessarily agree that it's just the state antagonizing the group. You have, as the state's tried to disrupt kind of its smuggling activities across the border from Algeria, they've set landmine for security forces. They've ambushed and killed security forces, which is not necessarily what I describe as state antagonism. And the second thing is you have the two assassinations of politicians. Now, as I said, there's some question about culpability. That doesn't mean that the group isn't responsible, right? It doesn't mean that, A, the assassinations weren't ordered, although I'm actually very skeptical that they were. But number two, that the group created a permissive environment in which things like this could occur. So I wouldn't be quite as harsh on the state there. But the second thing as to why they would do this, well, the Tunisian government, the Tunisian state, is very dependent upon the tourist industry, both in terms of the percentage of their economy and also the percentage of Tunisians who derive employment from the tourist industry. I think that 15% of Tunisians derive employment from the tourist industry. So if you can attack this source of wealth for the country, it's something that can they can significantly weaken the Tunisian state. If I'm gaming it out from the perspective of a group that wants to do significant damage to Tunisia, then being able to attack targets that are vital to its economy can in turn cause them to, could number one, make tourism revenues drive up, and number two, cause Tunisia to expend more resources to try to protect this sector, which again increases the expenses for the government. Back in 2011, I wrote a book called Bin Laden's Legacy, which makes the argument that Al-Qaeda, in its war against the United States, sees the U.S. economy as its center of gravity and thus tries to have a strategy that inflicts attrition upon the U.S. economy. Similarly, for a group like Ansar al-Sharia, looking at Tunisia, its economy is a point of vulnerability, And by carrying out a successful attack, you can cause even more resources to be expended to try to protect this sector.
Interesting. But how does that, I mean, how has that sort of played out with the greater population, the greater sort of Tunisians? I mean, wouldn't the purpose of this group to be sort of expand and sort of spread its ideology, yet it is sort of engaging in actions that wouldn't necessarily be deemed popular, you know, among the general population. So, you know, has that sort of these alleged acts sort of, you know, has that sort of soured them, or has that in the population's eyes sort of soured the group and sort of soured the reputation? I mean, what is, you know, what has been the response by, you know, the general population towards these acts?
Yes, it absolutely has. I could see very clearly during my last field research in Tunisia just about a week ago that Ansar al-Sharia is extraordinarily unpopular. It has, you know, this has hurt the group in multiple ways, including you know, the fact that they can't undertake dawah openly has hurt the recruitment. They're very unpopular in the eyes of the public. All of that has had a tremendous effect on the group. However, if you look at the way that insurgencies tend to begin, often what insurgent force will do is try to provoke the state, cause the state to overreact, then take advantage of the overreaction in order to recruit. Now, I spoke to you know, a number of people who were familiar with Tunisia's security sector during my time there, including people involved in security sector reform projects, including journalists. I heard widely divergent views about policing tactics. But that being said, one thing that I can infer is that whether this is being used massively or only occasionally, that the Tunisian police have used torture in some instances to extract information. As I said, the estimates as to how frequently it's used vary, and whether the direction of the security forces is positive or negative. But there are concerns that about the Tunisian state's efforts to clamp down on this group being too heavy-handed. As a result, you know, one possible problem that could arise in the future is that the Tunisian state is being too rough with people who are Salafi, and thus drives some people who already fall into the general category of Salafi into Ansar al-Sharia's hands. That's one thing that may end up happening. Now, I mean, to step back for a second, I think this the course of events that I described is interesting for the fact, and you know, we both put our finger on this, that there's some question about agency. There's some question as to who ordered what. Did the organization intend it? Do you have multiple kind of centers of power? That is, you know, is there more local implementation rather than implementation at top levels? And to me, it seems like Ansar al-Sharia actually didn't intend to trigger the crackdown against it. I think that, you know, for the assassinations and even for the specific violent incident in which, you know, five security forces' throats were slit and eight of them were killed total, that there may have been some more localized control or attacks on targets of opportunity going on. I don't think that the questions are answered, but I have my suspicions that it wasn't what was intended. So, you know, look, and that's not because, you know, it's a group that's not nonviolent. Rather, it's that they had a lot to lose strategically by ordering those specific acts at a top level. And so, you know, when you get to the attacks on tourist targets, you again have that question. Is this an organizational decision? Is this something that's being done by supporters against targets of opportunity? Like, what is the actual decision-making process? And that really is the key question for Ansar al-Sharia. Like, the key question of who is making the decisions is one that we don't have significant information on. And if we knew more about it, it could help us to better understand exactly what its strategic thinking is.
Interesting. So, I want to switch gears a little. I think we've covered this part, you know, this Ansar al-Sharia pretty well. But I want to switch gears and return to the idea that the Arab Spring started in Tunisia. You know, and there hasn't been a lot of coverage on Tunisia. maybe because, you know, the violence is relatively low when compared to Egypt or Syria. But I want to sort of look at Tunisia and sort of, you know, maybe think about it in terms of, is there a greater comment, you know, about the Arab Spring, you know, from Tunisia, you know, that we could sort of, you know, tease out in the sense of, you know, looking at, you know, political transition and its relationship to violence. I mean, maybe, Tunisia is probably a bad example because it's, you know, relatively nonviolent when compared to Egypt and Syria. But, you know, is there, you know, the Arab Spring, you know, writ large? I mean, is there sort of a greater comment about, you know, the perils of political transition and violence? I mean, what can we learn so far?
I think there absolutely is. And, you know, look, the fact that this is a relatively peaceful country, you know, shouldn't blind us to the fact that what they have witnessed is for them a massive and unprecedented rise in violence. You know, it's against a cultural context in which things like this aren't as common. So, you know, one lesson I would draw is that groups that are anti-democratic or violent in their end goals can prosper from an environment of newly won freedoms. That doesn't mean the freedoms are not worthwhile. Just like there are, you know, are groups in the United States that have you know, violent goals or otherwise highly problematic goals that take advantage of the U.S.'s freedoms. But the fact that this will happen during a time of transition is an important thing to understand. And incidentally, it was one of those reasons why I was at the very outset extraordinarily skeptical of the argument that many people were making that the jihadist movement was going to be devastated by the changes made in the Arab Spring. I mean, if you look at back at those debates, you had a whole lot of analysts, by far the majority looking at this, who really got that question wrong. I got that question right, not because, you know, more than anything, just because I understood a few different dynamics that were functioning in the direction of helping jihadist movements. So that's the first thing. You know, the second thing that's important is that as you have a transition that's occurring, you have a number of structural factors that are locked in. For example, the security services in Tunisia are, you know, in many ways remnants from the Ben Ali years. And that creates a set of problems. At first, it created, like a year ago when I was looking at the problem set, the problem was that because of suspicions of the security forces weren't getting the kind of support that they needed from the Tunisian state. They were often under-equipped. They felt that the state wasn't going to support them. Members of the security forces were being threatened by Salafists. And so they were really they were having trouble dealing with this wave of vigilante violence. And you know, when I was talking to human rights activists in Tunisia, including one researcher for Human Rights Watch, what she told me was that you know, this was a huge issue. The fact that the state was not actually responding adequately to the challenge of vigilante violence aimed against normal citizens by the Salafist movement. Now, when I go back there 10 months later, the problem has flipped a bit. You know, when I talked to a journalist who is very concerned about human rights, the concern wasn't so much Salafists violating the human rights of Tunisian citizens, but rather the state violating rights, including the rights of Salafists. Now, all of that is part and parcel of the fact that the policing tradition there is very much bound up in an authoritarian context. You know, another thing that they have a lot of trouble with is crowd control. If you look at protest situations, quasi-riot type situations, there's often an escalation. There often are people getting killed. When in the U.S., that wouldn't happen with the same degree of frequency. I mean, we have horrendous, very aggressive protest situations where people get injured, but where the police avoid killing people. And so that's another problem that states like this generally have trouble dealing with. So those are a couple of different lessons, but I think that there's also many other lessons one can spin off. There's a lot that this does say about transitions. And frankly, you know, we've highlighted problems, but it's worth saying that Tunisia by far is the best off of any of the Arab Spring countries, much more so than Libya, much more so than Egypt, much more so than Syria, hands down. I think overall life in Tunisia has actually gotten better, whereas it's, you know, in Syria it's clearly gotten worse. In Egypt or Libya, one could argue it either way, but there's a lot to be said for the position that life has not gotten better. In Tunisia, I think it has. I mean, there are certain ways in which life has gotten worse. It's more dangerous after dark, for example. The first time I went to Tunisia was 1997, and you know, going anywhere in the country, it felt perfectly safe after dark. That has changed. And you know, I met during my time there with the former Ben Ali minister, who you know, made a big point about that, about the difference in relative threat that one might experience from crime. And he was correct on that point. It actually has gotten more dangerous in that way. But overall, looking at Tunisia, you know, my own assessment is that that country is better off. And so, you know, despite the problems that it faces, and it does face problems, I think they can be proud of a lot of things, including the fact that they have gotten their constitution through. It's a country where there are major challenges, but they can be proud of what they have succeeded in doing.
So, as a research question, I'm sort of interested. I mean, you know, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, and let's say Syria too, were all authoritarian regimes. And even if you were to sort of remove Libya and remove Syria and just compare Tunisia and Egypt, you know, in your approximation, what has been the difference between the two, you know, as far as the security sector is concerned? I mean, it seems like they were both authoritarian regimes. They both, you know, used the police and the military to create order, you know, order not in the sense of the United States, but sort of authoritarian order. And yet, you know, it was a peaceful transition in Tunisia, a relatively peaceful one. And Egypt, it's, you know, coup after coup after counter coup. You know, what is the difference? I mean, what has been the key difference between the two?
Well, the initial transition in both countries was obviously peaceful. It's the post-transition, you know, or to put it differently, it's that Tunisia was able to make a complete transition, whereas Egypt has not. I think there's a few differences, and I'll just outline them kind of in order in which they came into play, not necessarily order of importance. One of which is the relative vibrancy of the secular tradition within the state. And I bring this into play because, as is quite well known, the Egyptian coup was against a Muslim Brotherhood government. In Tunisia, you had an Islamist government in power, Ennahda. But the relative vibrancy of secularism was much higher in Tunisia. You had a strong secularist faction representing about half the population that was basically strongly resisted any sort of you know, strong religious language being put into the constitution. Whereas if you look at the Islamist parties in Egypt, you know, the Brotherhood and the Nur Party, they won about 70% of the vote there. Which you know, speaks, among other things, to the relative vibrancy of secularism. That's one difference between the two. That doesn't quite get into the security sector because that's more at the level of political Islamist parties. But there is a second-order impact on the security sector. If you look at the Muslim Brotherhood when it was in power in Egypt, it was very hesitant to keep people in prison who were strongly affiliated with the jihadist movement. Even people for whom there was strong evidence of involvement in transnational violence. For example, Mohammed Jamal and the Jamal Network, they were able to operate relatively freely. All of the jihadists in Sinai were able to you know, stay free of prison during that time. That's one difference. A second difference is that the Egypt has a very strong military, which is very much embedded in Egyptian culture. And that's one reason why it was able to execute a coup, because it's so strong. Whereas Ben Ali was a career military man, and you know he came to power through a coup. Now, obviously, having come to power from a coup, he wanted to make sure that he wouldn't lose power in the same way. So he very much weakened the security sector in Tunisia. He actually placed a lot of power in his palace guard, and tried to keep the military small in order to avoid something like a coup happening. That meant that there was much less of a potential for there to be a coup against the Ennahda government as opposed to what happened in Tunisia. Those are the two differences I would highlight off the bat. Let me highlight a third as well, though. A third difference is when you look at the security sector, the depth of the security problems that you've had. You know, within Tunisia, you've had terrorism in the past. One could point to a number of acts of terrorism, but you've never had something in Tunisia which I would which could be characterized as an insurgency against the state. Whereas if you go back to the 1990s, you had the kind of violence in Egypt that could be, you know, you had a fairly high levels of violence being carried out by groups like Gamal al-Islamiyah and others. You had much more of a tradition of violent non-state actors within Egypt than in Tunisia. Now, those violent non-state actors had been dormant for a while in Egypt, but you had networks in place that had taken part in levels of violence that dwarf anything that one has seen in Tunisia.
Interesting. So I'm sort of curious, maybe, you know, to sort of look at the, as a research question too. I mean, is how much does violence play into extremism? Now, what I mean by this is, you know, when we compare Ansar al-Sharia in Tunisia versus, you know, ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria, I mean, is sort of the issue of violence, I mean, can we link that to extremism? Because it almost seems like, you know, Ansar al-Sharia, it may have engaged in violence, but, you know, relatively, you know, it's violence that is, you know, as you know, I read in the report and as you've sort of described here, you know, very, you know, low ball, you know, attempted bombings, as, you know, compared to Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS, where you have beheadings and, you know, sort of really grisly and gory violence. So I'm sort of curious, I mean, does violence, you know, sort of, is that a determinant in sort of the extremism and sort of, you know, the, you know, how much violence a group is willing to engage in and, you know, it's sort of, you know, ability to exist and sort of, you know, be active.
Go ahead.
I just threw a lot at you in that one question. I apologize.
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, there's multiple ways one can come at it. I mean, one way is looking at it in the way that you framed it, which is, you know, relative levels of extremism and the connection to violence. I mean, there's another thing that is quite obviously connected to it as well, which is, you know, what are the background factors? Syria has been in a state of civil war. And, you know, yes, you have beheadings in Syria. It's against a much more violent backdrop, one in which you've had, you know, over 120,000 people killed within the country, and 120,000 is a very low-ball estimate for the number of deaths there. And that's just a massive amount of deaths in a short time. It seems like that you've already had more people killed in the Syria conflict than were killed during the course of the entire Iraq war, which is just a massive, massive body count. And so you're starting from a baseline of, you know, this very violent conflict going on inside of Syria, you know, a collapse of state institutions and a rise of powerful, violent non-state actors. So it's no surprise that you have more grisly scenes within Syria, just like, you know, for, you know, Al-Qaeda in Iraq during the height of the Iraqi Civil War. I'm not going to say that it's no surprise that you had these grisly scenes, because they were very shocking to Iraqis. Hell, they were even shocking to Ayman al-Zawahiri, who, you know, wrote a letter reprimanding Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. But, you know, it's against a more violent backdrop. You know, the second thing is, you know, the fact that in general, these militant groups, as you put your finger on earlier, are attempting to reach populations. So there's the question of what is going to completely alienate a population. Then there's questions about tactical and strategic uses of violence. I mean, I think that it really is a massive question. It's a great question. but one that's difficult to answer with reference to any single factor.
Okay, I think we've sort of, you've answered all my questions, and as you know, we always like to let the guest have the last word, the last comment, so if you can, just, you know, give us something to chew on, something to think about, you know, until the next time.
Sure. What I would say to chew on is that there are three things that I think are going to have the biggest impact on Tunisia's future. because right now, the crackdown against Ansar al-Sharia seems to be going well, but the story of the conflict between the Tunisian state and Ansar al-Sharia is far from done. So one thing that I think is a big question is the Tunisian state's crackdown simply exceeding Ansar al-Sharia's ability to absorb this sort of damage? You know, there's a debate. There's been a debate for a while about the kind of damage that has been inflicted upon al-Qaeda's senior leadership. And you know, if one looks at the history of predictions about al-Qaeda's demise, as Bruce Hoffman just did in a recent academic article, one sees, you know, predictions again and again that the organization has been shattered when it wasn't. And one reason those predictions have been wrong in the past, and one reason I'm a bit more skeptical of claims of al-Qaeda core's demise than some other analysts, is because it has an organizational structure that's designed to ensure its survivability, one that is clandestine in nature, that is, they keep it hidden, and cellular, in that destroying one node in the network doesn't necessarily bleed over to other nodes. Now, the thing is, one reason that al-Qaeda's senior leadership has been able to use this organizational structure to their advantage is they have a very deep bench, whereas Ansar al-Sharia in Tunisia has a much, much shallower bench for a variety of reasons. So the first question is this going to simply exceed their ability to absorb these kind of blows? The second question is whether al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, the North African affiliate of al-Qaeda, will send fighters into Tunisia in order to enhance Ansar al-Sharia's capabilities. There's been a strong association between the two. And if al-Qaeda, the Islamic Maghreb, sends fighters to, say, attack tourist targets, that could change dynamics on the ground. And then the third question is one that I raised before, which is the lack of professionalism in the Tunisian security services. That could engender a backlash against the state. As I'd already said, that's something which I think is a grave concern. Does the state overreact in such a way that it drives people into Ansar al-Sharia's hand? I think those are the three factors that we really need to watch in this conflict.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
It was a pleasure, Sina, as it always is.
Thank you.